Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome Anna Porter. She is the author of Kastner's Train, The True Story of an Unknown Hero of the Holocaust. She will be speaking at Garcia Street Books this evening from 5 to 6. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. So, Rezső Kastner was born in 1907 in Hungary. Let's start with the part of his story, which is long before World War II. What was the place in society of Jews in Hungary before World War II and before the Nazi occupation?
It was relatively comfortable. They had been, Jews were fully emancipated. They took part in pretty much every walk of life. Some owned land, largely they had become members of a more intellectual class than I think pretty much anywhere else in Eastern Europe. They more like Germany. They were lawyers, doctors, engineers. A lot of them were writers, journalists, newspapermen, reporters. They owned some of them owned newspapers. They were involved in industry. They owned, they owned quite a lot of the industrial enterprises in Hungary. So they were well integrated into Hungarian life.
So Rezső Kastner was a natural politician. He was brilliant. He was fearless, even from an early age. And he became aware of National Socialism pretty early on. He even read Mein Kampf.
Yes, he did. He was a linguist, and he was able. He read the book in German, even before it had become a hugely popular item. It was already popular, but long before it had become a really major item in Germany, he'd read the book. He was educated partly in what is now Czechoslovakia, he really, for some reason, he determined that this man was and his ideas were dangerous.
And so the story really gets underway in the early 40s, and the story that's actually pretty well known of the rest of the world's resistance to allow European Jews to emigrate once the full-on persecution began. That's a dark chapter in the history of the 20th century with horrific consequences that we know about. There were also problems within Hungary, and in 1941, Kastner spent a great deal of time trying to help refugees who were coming from all over Europe into Hungary.
At this point, in 1941, in fact, right up until 1944, Hungary was an ally of Germany. It was, in fact, a safe haven for Poles and Slovaks and Czechs and anybody else who was escaping the Nazis. Countries that had already been invaded, Poland, where most of the Jews had already been ghettoized and a large portion of them had been murdered, for example. This had all happened before the Germans decided to invade their former ally. So, in fact, Rezső Kastner, who lived in a place now called Cluj, that used to be called Kolozsvár, he and everybody else already knew, they'd heard, and some, in fact, decided that they knew, but the stories they heard were so horrific of Jews being murdered in the streets of what had been civilized countries that a lot of people disbelieved the stories. But the refugees were coming by the thousands, and Rezső Kastner was involved in a kind of rescue operation already in his hometown before he went to the capital.
So that's an unusual situation that Hungary was both an ally of German and a safe haven for people escaping.
Yes, it was an ally of Germany, but the Germans stayed out, and the Hungarians managed a kind of a peculiar political tightrope act that allowed them considerable freedom, provided that they were willing to send some Hungarian armies off to support the German war effort, and these armies were in the east.
Now, this isn't a big part of the story, but Kastner met Oskar Schindler in 1942.
Yes, he did. He met, and the reason I'm chuckling is because they disliked each other almost instantly.
Right.
I did write a little bit about that in the book, but there's a great deal more because Schindler talks about the meeting in his own book, and he says in his own book that Kastner, that he didn't like Kastner, but that Kastner was by far the best informed and bravest man he had met. And Kastner writes about and talked about Schindler as a guy who was actually really in it for his own self-promotion, which was untrue. But Kastner's this little guy. He was relatively small-boned. He was maybe 5'7", 5'8", whereas Schindler is a giant of a man and somewhat threatening and boisterous and loud. Kastner was quiet and witty. The two of them could not have been more different. But what Schindler did was he informed Kastner and his associates, who were in Budapest by this time, running a larger and better organized rescue committee helping refugees. He informed Kastner that the camps that had been assumed to be work camps were actually extermination camps. Kastner didn't believe him. I mean, it was
right.
Hard to believe that this could be so.
Well, I think this is one of the things that's hard for us to really grasp, living so far distant from the events and having seen them in so many perspectives through films and books and the movies and conversations in school. During that period, it was very difficult for people to know what the truth was, and when the truth turned out to be so horrible, they still couldn't believe it. But how was the knowledge of what was happening in Germany and in Poland transmitted?
Well, mostly by refugees, really. The fact is, of course, the Allies already knew. They knew, but they were bent on winning the war in order to eliminate the horrors that were being perpetrated against defenseless civilians. But they didn't specifically go out to help Jews. As far as people living in Hungary, one of the things I really tried very hard to write in the book in a kind of a day-to-day way is how the horrors sort of piled up slowly, one at a time.
Right.
And you kind of people kept thinking, well, this is terrible, but we'll survive this, and then there'll be another day tomorrow, and perhaps, this is 1944, by time things got really, really tough in Hungary. And up until then, they believed, really, both the Gentiles and the Jews believed that the war was somehow going to end before things got really tough in Hungary. And one of the sad facts is that the Jewish leadership in Hungary, to the degree that there was any Jewish leadership, because the Jews were so integrated, there wasn't a lot of Jewish leadership, but to the extent that there was, they really believed that the horrors were a kind of a peculiar Eastern thing, that these things can perhaps happen in you know, uncivilized places like the Ukraine and in backward Galicia, but there's no way this would happen here, not in our beautiful cities. So really, as things got progressively worse, they were in denial all along.
Right. Except for Roger Kastner.
Well, except for Roger Kastner, although in reading his writings, really even he kept hoping that the end of the war was closer than it was, and that when he started dealing with the Germans after the occupation, that somehow if he could prolong the process of bargaining with them for human lives, which is what he did, he bargained for human lives, that somehow it would all, if he could prolong it, it would all be over before the ultimate price was paid.
And there are a number of conversations that you describe in the book of his talking to other Jewish leaders and trying to explain to them and convince them how bad it was and what needed to be done and what needed to be done right away. And some of them would hide behind things like, well, we don't have the exact proper authority or paperwork and therefore we can't do things. And it drove him absolutely crazy.
This is absolutely right. He was not, he never became a leader in the community because he came from a smaller town. And by the time he met Schindler, he was already in Budapest, where he's a little fish in a large bowl. And whatever notions he had about horrors to come, the community leaders, who were really upstanding members of society and very, you know, I mean, they were lawyers, they were judges, they were highly educated people. Some of them played bridge with the governor. The last thing they could imagine was the horror to come, that all their honors and all their brilliance and acumen would amount to nothing, which is, of course, what happened.
We're talking to Anna Porter, author of the book Kastner's Train, The True Story of an Unknown Hero of the Holocaust. And she will be at Garcia Street Books tonight from 5 to 6 in the evening here in Santa Fe. So in March of 1944, the Germans marched into Budapest. How did the people react? Did they then know how bad it was?
Well, the people that I'm writing about, their initial reaction was, can we fight? Can we get some arms? But they didn't have any guns. They had no way of forming a resistance group. They tried. They reached out. Roger Kastner and his associates reached out to various members of opposition parties, the more liberal party members in Hungary, and even the socialists and communists. They tried to reach out to see if some kind of resistance could be organized, but there was no appetite for resistance. The Germans came in overnight, and they occupied immediately. They occupied downtown Budapest. They arrived, and almost immediately, within hours, they rounded up Jewish intellectuals and people they thought might be influential, both in the Gentile world and amongst the Jews. They appeared at the doors of the Sheep Street Jewish headquarters in Budapest, the Jewish community headquarters, and they announced they wanted to have a meeting with Jewish leaders, and they were going to tell them to organize themselves into units that the Germans could handle, which is, of course, what they had done elsewhere in Europe. This is what they'd done, and it was a tried, and you organize them into groups, and you have them hand over whatever they have, that you rob them, you concentrate them in ghettos, and then you deport them. And that was the German plan, and that had worked in other countries, and they were now going to start and do it here.
And the speed at which they did that was astounding. I mean, they were able to wreak an incredible amount of havoc really quickly.
Very, very quickly. That really is, in fact, unique to the German procedures elsewhere, because in Poland, people lived in horrific circumstances in places like the Warsaw and Łódź ghetto for years before the transport started, whereas in Hungary, I'm using the excuse that these were strategically important locations, given that the Soviet armies were approaching from the east. They started immediately to round up Jews in eastern Hungary, and in very short order, they started deporting them already in May. They started deporting them to Auschwitz-Birkenau.
So what did Reju Kastner do next? And we should emphasize that he wasn't, of course, working alone. He was working with other people.
Yes, he was working with a group. I think perhaps the most sort of the best known member of that group, to the degree that any member of that group has had any just due from history, is Joel Brand, who worked with him pretty much from the beginning in Budapest. And it was Brand who was the first man in this little group to meet Adolf Eichmann, who is arguably the architect, or at least mechanic, of the Holocaust, who had arrived with a contingent of his best men in Budapest. And Joel Brand was summoned to see him, and Joel was given the task of offering trucks for lives or lives for trucks to the Allies through the Jewish representatives, the yeshuv, the representatives of the Palestinian Jewish community in Istanbul. And Eichmann actually allowed Joel to go to Istanbul in order to meet these guys, who he was convinced represented some major worldwide Jewish power. Whereas Joel Brand arrived, they hadn't even managed to get him the proper passport. He had difficulty staying in Istanbul for any length of time because the Turks were going to deport him as an enemy alien. They were a small, ragtag bunch of people who were themselves desperate to find any means whatsoever to save fellow Jews. They had very, very good spies. They knew what was going on. They knew Jews were being murdered. And by this time, there were about 4 million who had been killed. So it was not, I mean, they weren't guessing. But, of course, they had no power. So when Joel Brand arrived with his blood for trucks deal, he had a willing audience, but totally unable to actually accomplish what Eichmann had proposed, which is for one truck, he would give the Allies 100 Jews. So at that point, the idea was that perhaps a million lives could be saved.
So the Germans were not only brutal, but they were corruptible.
Oh, and, yes.
And so they took trucks, they took money, they took all sorts of things. How was there any trust at all that the German part of the deal would then be carried out once the bribe was given?
Well, the blood for what became known as this Joel Brand deal, that was, in fact, it reached the White House and it reached the Parliament in London and was rejected. So the trucks, this never happened. This was a deal being offered that the Allies determined, having reviewed it, was merely a ploy, that it wasn't, they didn't believe it for one moment. They didn't believe that the Germans were really going to sell them lives for trucks. What they thought was that the Germans were trying to split the Allies, because they had said, Eichmann's message was, that the trucks would be used only on the Eastern Front. So it was their belief, Churchill's belief, that this was a crude ploy to try and create a rift between the Americans and the British on the one hand, and Stalin's Soviet army on the other hand. So this actually didn't occur. However, Kastner, now having met Eichmann while his friend Joel was trying to negotiate something in Istanbul, Kastner, fully convinced that the Germans indeed were corruptible and the Nazis were particularly corruptible, now that it's, you know, the summer of 44, he tried to negotiate on behalf of this mythical world jury in which Eichmann believed. And Eichmann believed because Hitler had written about it in Mein Kampf. Hitler believed there was some world government of powerful Jews.
I mean, really, it really is an extraordinary thing that Eichmann was negotiating with a mythical set of people, in a sense.
Yep, he was. But, you know, I mean, Kastner managed to convince him that this mythical set of people existed.
Right.
And that he, Kastner, was their spokesman. Because he believed that it was the only way to be able to negotiate, because otherwise he'd just be another victim in Auschwitz, or he could have been killed at any moment, any second. During the many meetings that he had with Eichmann, Eichmann could have just pulled a gun and shot him point blank without the slightest repercussion. It's in this atmosphere that Kastner was negotiating for human lives.
And so what was the nature of those negotiations?
Well, the nature of negotiations was that Kastner presented himself, Kastner being very, very smart. And as I mentioned, he was a linguist, but what I didn't say is that one of the languages he spoke absolutely fluently and with a classy accent was German.
Mm-hmm.
He actually spoke a classier brand of German than Eichmann.
Wow.
And he presented himself. Initially, he was terribly, terribly nervous, but he managed to steel himself through a series of negotiations that initially involved saving perhaps 300, and then it went up to 350, and then it ended up being almost 2,000 people on a train that would not be going to Auschwitz, where people would be exterminated, but would go to a neutral country. That was the first deal that they made, and he pretended that he was getting funding for this deal from this mythical, non-existent Jewish body, wherever.
And meanwhile,
whereas in fact, he was collecting gold, coins, jewelry, share certificates, right, anything he could get from Hungarian Jews.
So this all came from Hungarian Jews. And I have to
yes.
say, while reading it, one really, in so many different pages of this book, cannot help but think, what would I have done in that situation? Would I have handed over all my jewelry, my gold coins, my money, and so on?
You're absolutely right. Those are the very thoughts. But also, you asked a question earlier about why would people believe the Nazis, and why would they believe that if they turned over their jewelry, their lives would be saved, when in other places they were robbed and then murdered? Quite a lot of people paid for seats on this train, which was to go initially to Spain, but they changed their minds. They got off the train, some people got off the train, some people paid for the seats and never got on the train in the first place, because that's the very question they were asking themselves, what you just also asked. Why would you believe that Eichmann would be as good as his word when his word was not worth anything?
So tell us the story of the train. What actually happened?
The train did not go to Spain. The explanation for that from the SS was that the war had interfered, and indeed the Allies had landed and they couldn't get through to Spain, so Eichmann had the train redirected to Bergen-Belsen. Bergen-Belsen at this point was not yet the horror that it became shortly after, when the Allies liberated that camp early the next year, I think April or May of the following year. By then it was a death camp. But at this point it was still a kind of a safekeeping camp for possible trading and a labor camp. This is where he redirected the train. And then once the train was there, he and his cohorts concluded that this is a good chance to try and get more out of the Jews.
So basically, they really just didn't live up to their end of the bargain.
No, they did not. They did not. Kastner by now was dealing with a second guy in addition to Eichmann. He was dealing with a man called Kurt Andreas Becher, a high-ranking SS officer who reported directly to Himmler. And his main task was to get as much as possible out of the Jews. That was his job. So he and Kastner started negotiating at the Swiss border with a representative of the American Jewish Rescue Committee. And again, promises, absolutely no money ever changed hands. Because unbeknownst to the Germans, the man negotiating had nothing, and Kastner had no authority. However, they believed it was coming. And with that in mind, they did let these two groups, the original train load, split into two groups. They allowed them to get out of Nazi-occupied Europe into Switzerland.
And so these 1,684 people did end up in Switzerland?
Yes.
How was it? You said Kastner could have been shot at any time. He had a strong character that's almost unfathomable. Day after day after day, he negotiated with the Nazis, and he didn't break down. He
yes.
was able to continue doing this life-and-death work for a long period of time.
He was an extraordinary character. He was very, very strong, and he was quite amazingly brave. But he also had a secret weapon in that he had a woman associate who was also a member of the rescue committee who loved him and encouraged him and, in fact, taught him a lot of the things that helped him fool Eichmann. For example, Eichmann chain-smoked, and Kastner didn't smoke. Hansi Brand, who in addition to being Kastner's lover, was also the wife of his friend Joel, which is another story we won't go into now.
That would feature bigger in the Hollywood movie version.
Oh, there's this great, great love story, but she taught him how to chain-smoke, and she also taught him how to march up and down furiously, like Eichmann did. Eichmann was in the habit of shouting and waving his arms while marching up and down and whamming his heels into the parquet floors of the Majestic Hotel, which was his headquarters. And Hansi Brand taught Roger Kastner how to do that. Now, I should say, before your listeners are outraged, that the marriage between Hansi and Joel was an arranged marriage. It was not a love match, unlike the affair between Hansi and Reju. And in fact, during his trial many years later, Adolf Eichmann talked about Hansi Brand and said that she, as far as he could see, was the brains of the operation.
Well, there were no brains lacking in Reju Kastner, who was both very selfless and an incredible negotiator. Meanwhile, his own wife was on his train, is that correct, and ended
yes.
up in Bergen-Belsen?
Yes, she was in Bergen-Belsen, and she got out in December, and she survived. And the two of them did, in fact, try to put their marriage back together again, as did Hansi and Joel. They tried to put their marriage back together for the sake of children in both cases. And eventually they all ended up in Israel or in Palestine at that moment, but shortly to become the State of Israel.
Now, in addition to Kastner's train, he saved the lives of many more people. How did he do that?
He negotiated that Eichmann's group should put a certain number of Jews on what they called on ice, as if putting them in an ice box for future use, meaning that in the event that the Allies would negotiate, and you know, this is getting late, it's getting close to the end of the war, even people like Himmler and Becker, who in addition to being utterly evil, were also not stupid, could see that the war was going to end and Germany was not going to win. And they were now willing to at least consider the possibility of allowing more people to escape. It's very difficult with the numbers. The German count was closer to 30,000, and the lowest Hungarian count is about 20,000 Jews, mostly women and children, and older people were sent to place in a kind of a transition camp near Vienna called Strasshof, and thence they were dispersed amongst a variety of farms and small towns and Vienna itself. In the towns, they were doing mostly rubble removal, and on the farms, they were working the land. Most of these people survived. Again, Kasner's task, in addition to paying for the privilege of these people being possibly saved, and they were, he paid so much per head, and in addition to that, he was to supply food and clothing so that they would not be a burden on the German economy. And these people, I mean, I have met a number of them in the past little while since the book was published, and I've heard from many more who they did indeed survive. It was not wonderful, but it was better than Auschwitz by a long shot.
Another thing that your book makes clear is the vast amount of money and property that went from Jewish to Nazi hands during this period, not only from bribes, but just outright theft and possession of people's valuables, of their homes, and so on.
Oh, yes. And you know, the value of people's everything people owned, including, well, obviously, I mean, one of the most famous cases involving the theft of art, I'm sure you know
right.
about. I mean, it's still ongoing.
Right. Now, Budapest was liberated by the Soviets, and what happened then?
Budapest was liberated by the Soviets. Rezsa Kastner was not in Budapest anymore at this point. He was, in fact, mostly in Vienna, trying to supply winter clothing, food, whatever, to the Strasshof people, medications and so forth. And by now, he was sort of bribing the Nazis with promises of good treatment after the Germans had lost the war. By the time the Soviet army arrived in Hungary, even an idiot could see that Germany was going to lose and lose quickly, and he promised a number of the SS that he would help them when it was all over. It had been announced on the BBC that war criminals would be punished, and he said he would testify on their behalf. And with that, he helped the Strasshof group survive, and he also managed to talk Kurt Becker into going to a couple of the camps, including Bergen-Belsen, and present orders to the commandants not to murder the remaining inmates. So he kept going until the very end, but not in Budapest. He couldn't get through the lines by then. Budapest was bombed, almost completely destroyed in the battle between the Nazis and the Soviets, between the German forces and the Soviets. The plea from Hungarian leaders to spare Budapest was ignored specifically by Hitler. He was willing to throw anything and everything in, even at the very end of the war, to keep the Allied armies and the Soviets in particular out of Vienna. As you remember, he was originally Austrian.
Right. Eventually, Rezsa Kastner and his wife moved to Palestine and were there then for the creation of Israel. What did they do? What did he do?
He worked for a newspaper, a Hungarian language newspaper. He also attempted to get involved in politics. He worked for one of the ministers in a very junior position in the new government once Israel came into being. He had a brother who already lived in Israel, so he had a little bit of a reception. They lived in abject poverty, in a basement, one-room basement apartment. He ended the war with nothing. And he was, you know, he was working very hard. He was trying to get a little bit more so they could have a better apartment and so on and so forth, and which they did in the end. They moved into a one-bedroom that was above street level. This is the position that he held. He was writing for a newspaper, and he was also employed by one of the ministers in cabinet as a junior civil servant. It's in this. This is the position he occupied when he was libeled in a small publication in Israel. By now, it's August 1952. And an elderly gent by the name of Grunewald wrote a most horrific thing about him, accusing him of having enriched himself at the expense of his fellow Hungarian Jews, and hobnobbing with, being buddies with the Nazis.
What a horrible slap in the face after everything that he had spent those years doing.
Yes, a horrible slap in the face, but nevertheless, you know, it was such a small publication. It was such an insignificant little thing that nobody really took seriously, and the guy who'd written it, even he wasn't taken seriously in Israel in 1952, that Reje was going to just sort of let it pass. But the Attorney General of the State of Israel insisted that no government official, no matter how small his job, could stand by while being accused of being an outright collaborator for profit. So they sued. The State of Israel sued on behalf, it's criminal libel, and the State of Israel sued on behalf of Reje Kastner, sued for libel.
And what happened next?
Initially, it was okay. Reje got a chance to testify on his own behalf, and he was the first witness, and this is the first time he was able to really talk, and he did for many hours. He talked about how and what he had achieved, and he was quite pleased with the attention that he finally had a chance to say all these things. But the trial turned against him. At Grunewald's side, the attorney was a brilliant young Sabra attorney whose first language was Hebrew. It was definitely not Kastner's first language, not even his third language. Nevertheless, the trial was conducted in Hebrew because Kastner chose to have it conducted in Hebrew. He said, it's, you know, the language of my people, so I'll be able to handle it. But it turned against him. Shmuel Tamir, that brilliant young attorney, saw an opportunity of turning the trial of Grunewald into the trial of Reje Kastner. And that is what happened. Now, the reason why he wanted to do that had little to do with Reje Kastner. It had a great deal to do with the fact that he was a member of the Harut, or right-wing party, and the current government at that point in Israel was run by the Labor Party. The leaders of the Labor Party were the very people who had been the original leadership of the Yishuv, and these were the people he believed had not done enough during the war. He believed that the leadership should be forced to testify on behalf of Kastner, and that they should be discredited, and his party, the Harut Party, should take over the government. So that was at the back of his mind. I know it's very complicated, but that was at the back of Shmuel Tamir's mind. Nevertheless, he was able to turn, and he was successful at turning the trial into an accusation of Kastner. And after the longest libel trial in the history of Israel, the judge found in favor of the defendant, Grunewald, and in his summation, he said that Roger Kastner had sold his soul to the devil.
Now, eventually, Kastner's reputation was saved, but next thing you know, he was murdered.
Well, his reputation, oddly enough, wasn't saved. You know, you would think it would be saved when the Superior Court, the Supreme Court of Israel, overturned the original judgment.
Right.
You would think his reputation would have been saved, but it wasn't. And it still isn't 100%. He's still a controversial figure today in Israel and, you know, everywhere where people talk about these events in Hungary. He has remained a controversial figure. He was, in fact, murdered before the Supreme Court handed down its judgment exonerating him. He was murdered in front of his own home and died. Well, he was shot and died shortly after. And the people who killed him were, in fact, caught and prosecuted and served jail time.
Now, this is a huge undertaking on your part. How did you do the research for this book? Did Reju Kastner leave behind detailed accounts of his daily life in Hungary?
He did leave some, but I wish it had been that easy. I had a full-time job when I first came across this amazing story of this extraordinary man and woman, really, because I think,
yeah.
One of the things I'd done more about Hansi, because she was such an amazing woman. But it's about 7 years ago now, and I had a full-time job, but I became so intrigued by the story that I started reading, I did read Roger Kastner's own accounts, but I also read many, many, many other accounts, books, documents. I researched in Hungary, in Israel, in Washington, in New York, in Germany, in Berlin. I traveled widely and I interviewed over 100 people, some of whom indeed knew him, some of whom knew him well. I wasn't sure about him for at least 2 years into my research, when I concluded that he really was not only a hero, but a greatly misjudged, very moral man.
In addition to being the story of Reju Kastner's life, it's really the story of Hungary during that period and a look in once again into the horrible story that is World War II. It must have been hard for you living with this and working with this material, even though you weren't living it yourself.
It was, and I think, you know, I'm still not over it. I mentioned that I was working full time. I quit my job I sold my company. I quit my job in order to finish the story, because what I was reading and hearing was so horrific that I didn't find enough time in my day to be able to run my publishing company. I really was absorbed by the sheer magnitude of the horror of it all, by the combination of one great guy, albeit not a perfect human being, a wonderful woman, a cast of characters that were riveting in themselves, and this cauldron of evil in which they somehow managed not only to survive, but to save so many others.
Well, it's a beautifully written book and a tremendous contribution to the history of this time. Anna Porter is the author of Kastner's Train, The True Story of an Unknown Hero of the Holocaust. Thank you so much for writing it and for speaking to us all this time on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much indeed, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate the time.
Anna Porter will be tonight at Garcia Street Books from 5 to 6 in the evening here in Santa Fe.
You are listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe right here at KSFR 101.1 FM on your radio dial. And this is Laurel Reynolds, and I'm here to talk for just a few minutes on the cafe about an upcoming photography event. I'd like to introduce Jackie Matei. Are you there, Jackie?
Hi, good morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. So tell us a little bit about yourself as a photographer and what this is that's coming up.
Okay. Well, about myself as a photographer, I've been doing photography forever. And I most what I love about it is sharing it with others and getting people to really have fun with it and explore it. And it's explore their own vision. I think that's a very valid thing. And for me, it's been a key component of my life. So it brings me great joy to share it with others.
Uh-huh.
And I want to start by thanking everybody who came out for the Camera Obscura event that we did on Worldwide Pinhole Day back in April. It was a really fun day, and the sunshine cooperated, and we had a great crowd. And I just wanted to thank everybody who bothered to come.
So Camp Obscura here in June is also going to focus on pinhole photography?
It is. It's completely on pinhole photography and the silver process. We build cameras from scratch. We build 4x5 super wide cameras that accept film holders, so they become beautiful tools that last. We use paper and film to create negatives, and we develop our own film, and we carry it on through to printing it in the cyanotype and the Van Dyck process.
You know, these materials are pretty, it seems like they're pretty rustic, and I've seen some of your work online, and it's really gorgeous. It seems like it does have a non-contemporary sort of feel to it.
It does. It becomes very intuitive and sort of mysterious and dreamlike. And, even people who have participated in the camp in the past, some come that are brand new to photography and some come that have years of experience behind them. But equally, they come out with the, incredible images. And I think they all come away with new knowledge because it takes you right down to, like, the basics and the core of what photography really is all about.
Yeah, it's quite a contrast with today's contemporary technology, I guess,
on
all kinds of levels.
It is indeed. If you think about it, if you're using pinhole, and you're really, all photography, you're painting with light, but in pinhole photography, there's absolutely nothing between your light-sensitive material and the light itself. So it's a very pure process, and it kind of allows for other things to happen because there's a longer time length. And things aren't completely in your control. And I think the way photography has progressed has become more and more controlling. So pinhole is kind of nice that you pull back and sort of let go and let other things happen.
Right. Well, in the few moments we have left, give us the rundown on the event and when and where it's taking place.
Well, we're doing it, and it's a wonderful location on Canyon Road, the Friends Meeting House.
Oh, that is a lovely little garden spot.
Oh, it's great, and it's nice to be right there in the summer in the action on Canyon Road and have all those photo opportunities. We're doing it in June. It's happening for two extended weekends. We'll be working together from Thursday till Sunday on June 12th through the 15th, and then we'll meet again the following weekend on June 19th through the 22nd. And I've designed it so that on Thursdays and Fridays, we meet a little later. We start at 4, and we go till 8. And then on Saturday and Sunday are full 12 to 8-hour days.
Okay. Well, Jackie, we are unfortunately running out of time. But go ahead and give your website really quickly.
www.campobscura.com. And can I give my phone number?
Yeah.
505-231-3758. We'd love to see some more people come out for the camp.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jackie Matei.
Thank you for your time.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.